Hello, everybody, whoever you are out there. This is David Rovics hosting another edition of episode of Fifth Estate Live, which comes to you every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And you can also find it afterwards at fifthestate.org. And Fifth Estate is a now quarterly anarchist magazine that you can get in physical form and occasionally in online as well. But mostly it's a physical print magazine and with an amazing cover this month by Seth DeBachman. And we have this weekly program where we've been generally interviewing Fifth Estate contributors, and who generally include a lot of authors and activists and other notable folks. And today we are talking with Sander Katz, who is talking to us from, I believe, on Short Mountain in rural Tennessee, amongst the land of the Radical Fairies. And Sander has written a multitude of books about fermentation and many other subjects. And with no further ado, Sander Katz, great to have you here.
Great to be with you, David. Thanks for having me.
And fermentation, I mean, it's a fascinating subject to have written so many books about, but it's like also, I mean, having spent a lot of time in cold climates where people are really attached to their fermentation, you know, even today, like, can you put fermentation in a little context? Like, where would humans be without fermentation?
Well, I mean, arguably humans and other aerobic life forms wouldn't exist without fermentation, because it's, you know, what would be described as fermentative processes by the earliest anaerobic bacteria and archaea that produced the oxygen in the atmosphere that enables us to exist. So, going back to the very beginning, fermentation is really important. And, you know, in terms of contemporary human cultures, you know, fermentation is an essential part of how people everywhere, you know, make effective use of whatever food resources that are available to them. And fermentation is practiced everywhere, not only in, you know, relatively cold climates. It's practiced in all of the tropical regions of the world as well. And, you know, there's a just incredible number of different benefits of fermentation. I mean, alcohol is the most, you know, sort of, you know, widespread type of fermentation. So, you know, fermentation produces alcohol. Fermentation can preserve food. Fermentation can make nutrients and foods more easily available. Fermentation can remove toxic compounds from certain foods. Fermentation is used to make fuel and to save fuel. So, you know, I mean, there's just, you know, an incredible range of practical benefits to fermentation. And it's, you know, just part of the context, part of the, you know, kind of inherited cultural information that people, you know, all in all parts of the world use to make effective use of whatever food resources they have available.
Have you been seeing a massive upswing in interest in what you've got going on in your books and in your workshops since the pandemic? I know that bread maker sales are through the roof.
Sure. I mean, there's lots of people, haven't been going about their typical activities and have time at home, and certainly, you know, baking bread and other kinds of fermentation projects have been something that people with a little extra time have taken up. But I mean, from my perspective, you know, I've been watching fermentation grow in popularity since my first book came out in 2003. So, I just see, you know, sure, the pandemic has brought some additional interest in the topic, but, you know, from my perspective, interest in the topic has been building over these last 2 decades. You know, lots and lots of people are interested in fermentation for, you know, a variety of different reasons.
I mean, with the whole back to the land movement in the 60s and 70s, I mean, there were a lot of more interest in sort of traditional agricultural methods but permaculture, but fermentation is why is it the past 20 years that fermentation has? I mean, kombucha is now, of course, everywhere. I mean, I live in probably the kombucha capital of the country here in Portland, but. Why is there any particular reason why it took off just in the past 20 years? It was your book that did it, maybe.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say that it was my book that did it. I would say more that I had really good timing. And, you know, my book came out at a moment when a lot of people were getting interested. And I mean, I would say that there are, you know, two major, you know, reasons that explain the explosion in interest in fermentation. First of all, I would just point out that the products of fermentation have enjoyed enduring popularity. So, you know, even, you know, during the time that we were growing up and nobody was talking about fermentation, but, you know, still, you know, as a kid, you know, my parents were drinking beer and wine, and we always had yogurt, and we sometimes ate sauerkraut, and we loved pickles, and we ate chocolate, and my parents drank coffee, and, you know, I mean, there were, you know, we ate cheese, we ate bread, you know, the products of fermentation have really enjoyed enduring popularity. And it's just that, you know, during the 20th century, you know, as fewer and fewer people were involved in the production of food, and, you know, people were still excited about the concept of the supermarket and the centralized place where you could go to get everything that you needed, you know, people just were increasingly losing touch with, you know, where does food come from? How is food produced? So, you know, not many people were thinking about the idea that the cheese that we're all eating every day is a product of fermentation. The bread that we're all eating every day is a product of fermentation. And I would say, like, beginning with the new millennium, you know, two important things shifted. I mean, the first one, and probably the major one, is the Human Microbiome Project. So, you know, all of us who were raised in the 20th century, you know, only heard about how dangerous bacteria were. You know, we never heard anything about how important they were. But beginning with the Human Microbiome Project and, you know, mapping the genetic complexity of the trillion plus bacteria that each of us is host to, and you know, there was increasing research on, you know, why these bacteria were functionally important, and, you know, the diminishment of biodiversity and various factors that were causing that. And so people just got interested in you know, bacteria for health, the idea of probiotics. And so, you know, fermented foods are a major source of probiotic bacteria. So that's number one. You know, number two, I would say that, like, you know, for my grandmother's generation and my mother's generation, the supermarket was liberation and, you know, spending less time in the kitchen. And I would say that, you know, by around the turn of the millennium, people were saying, well, convenience is great, but, you know, what's the downside of this? People started noticing, oh, the methods that allow this kind of food mass production are destroying the earth and, you know, creating pollution and depleting water resources, and packaging of mass-produced foods is wasteful, and the foods themselves are nutritionally diminished. So, you know, there was increasingly, you know, a movement of people interested in how their food was produced. And, you know, once you start asking questions about how your food is produced, fermentation is part of the answer. So I think that these are the two reasons why fermentation has been getting, you know, more popular.
That makes a lot of sense. And the whole microbiome thing is very interesting. And then the way that a probiotic approaches to curing cancer and stuff like that is becoming more and more the approach among scientists who are working on this stuff, rather than, like, destroying the immune system, but trying to be more targeted and building up the right kinds of bacteria. And that's not that it's a subject of expertise, but I keep on running into that stuff, you know, just in the popular press.
I mean, I think really, like, you know, the short-term future of medicine is really all about targeted probiotic therapies.
Mm-hmm. You're in the 90s, you you publish books, I imagine, on contract from Scholastic or some kind of press outlet that you wrote. But I mean, I was looking at your Wikipedia page among other places, but you have a degree in history and a background in history, and I wonder if your connection with history. Obviously, you're telling the story of food as well as talking about food here in the historical context when you talk about your parents and grandparents. But is there any particular connection there for you, like in how you got into this line of work or living?
Well, okay. So first, let me just explain that, you know, the books that you saw, yeah, in the 90s, I wrote a children's biography of Anne Frank and then another children's biography of Whoopi Goldberg. And I mean, basically, I had a friend who was the editor of these series biographies, and he had a list of people he needed biographies of. And it was right when I had moved to...
Like that.
Yeah. I had moved to the community in Tennessee, and you know, when I lived in New York, the pay scale of that didn't make sense. But you know, in my life in Tennessee, it was a great opportunity. So I wrote a couple of kids' books until my friend lost his job, and then you know, I was no longer on the list. I mean, I studied history in college. I mean, not in an extremely focused way, but I mean, I'm very interested in, you know, in history and particularly like, you know, recovering lost stories and lost strands of history. And, I would certainly say that, my interest in fermentation, well, didn't develop out of that, but I sort of, you know, brought my interest in history and, you know, the idea of lost narratives, to fermentation and to the books that I've written about fermentation. Absolutely, I would say that's very relevant to how I have approached the topic of fermentation.
It was when you mentioned that fermentation is something that exists in tropical parts of the world too. I mean, I don't know. It makes sense when you mention it, because of course, for one thing, alcohol is consumed everywhere in the world, right? But when I think about, I know another thing from Wikipedia that we both have recent ancestors from Belarus, and like places like Belarus or places like Scandinavia, where I spend a lot of time before the pandemic. Like at these places, I can't imagine they'd have much of a human population if it weren't for pickling, fermenting, and canning and drying.
And even more so when you go to the extreme northern reaches. I mean, you know, Greenland, Alaska, Siberia, northern parts of Canada. I would say the far northern regions of the world would never have been habitable for people without, fermentation and other techniques for preserving the bounty that's available to people during the summertime to enable them to survive through the winter when food resources are, not so abundant.
Yeah.
But in the tropics, the applications of fermentation tend to be a little bit different. So, in tropical places where they're, raising animals for milk, I mean, in a tropical place, the milk is going to stay fresh for even less time than it does in a temperate environment. And so, you know, fermentation is a strategy for extending the life of the milk. And that's what, you know, sort of yogurt and cheeses, you know, really ultimately have been about is, taking this most perishable of food resources and extending its useful life. Another thing is that many plants that grow in a tropical area or certain plants that grow in a tropical area have toxic compounds that can be broken down by fermentation. So like, you know, in the Amazon and in the Caribbean and in West Africa, the cassava grows with high concentrations of cyanide, which could literally kill people if they didn't process the tubers properly. And, the most widespread way of processing cassava to remove the cyanide is, just really peeling it, chopping it up in coarse chunks and putting it in a bucket of water. And then once it's in a wet environment, bacteria break down those cyanide compounds into harmless forms. People in different places have, you know, applications of fermentation driven by very different kinds of needs. But still, they're the transformative action of microorganisms at work.
Right. Yeah. Fascinating. I mean, things like beans are, would be, well, I think actually I read that one of the most common reasons for hospitalizations in the United States is people eating undercooked beans
Oh, interesting.
because of the,
Interesting.
you know, of course now I don't remember where that number, that information came from. So it's immediately suspect in my mind, you know, but I'm, it's apparently a big, it's a big, huge problem with, I mean, if beans aren't cooked enough, then they are, they're toxic along with so much other food, right? If it's not properly prepared, cooked, fermented, or whatever else it needs to, that needs to happen to it before it's actually palatable, right? I think a lot of the native foods in Australia need a lot of preparation before they're actually palatable.
No, I definitely. I mean, it's funny because in the early years that I was doing this, people were always telling me that they believed that Australia was the one place in the world where fermentation had not really developed prior to its colonization. And when I went to Australia, I went on a wild foods walk with an Aboriginal elder. And the very first tree we stopped to talk about was littered with nuts on the ground. And we picked up these nuts, but he cautioned us, like, don't eat them. They're very, very toxic. You have to soak them in water for a few days before they're safe to eat. Well, I mean, guess what happens when you soak something dry like a nut in water? Is it awakens bacteria on the nut that, you know, in this case, are breaking down some compound that's toxic otherwise.
And that was just a form of fermentation that people weren't familiar with, so they said that Australians didn't do it. Is
Well,
that the
I mean, often when people make generalizations, they,
yeah.
you know, they don't have the full information.
Yeah.
I don't know, you know, I mean,
But you
fermentation
figured
is
it
not
out pretty quick, right?
fermentation is not like a unified practice around the world. I mean, you know, all of these different processes, you know, sort of arose independently, and they all sort of spread as people, you know, have migrated or trading routes have developed or you know, sort of more modern globalization processes, but. You know, it wasn't really until the end of the 19th century that that science had a definitive understanding of what unified this phenomenon of fermentation. And so, you know, certain things that are ancient practices, people weren't thinking of them as fermentation. Yeah, it's hard to say in this case, but it turns out that in Australia, there's also ancient traditions of making alcohol from the sap of a certain tree. And I mean, that's not the only, you know, I mean, really those generalizations that a couple of people told me were just, you know, basically ignorant overgeneralizations. And we see plenty of those.
Plenty of those. Speaking of ignorant overgeneralizations, I wonder, can we talk about where you live there? I mean, I know you're originally from New York, right? Where I also am from. And you live in a fairly, at least in in Tennessee, certainly a fairly legendary sort of intentional community on short
Well,
land,
I
right?
should say that I did live in this
You did.
intentional
Okay, but so now
community
you're in still in
with this
Tennessee, but
intention.
not there.
I still live down the road, but I don't live in the community anymore. I lived in the community for 17 years, from 1993 till 2010. You know, I'm still friends with the community. I still, you know, go over there and do things, but I live down the road.
That's it. For many people, that's kind of the best of both worlds. I know many former communards who moved just down the road from the commune, and it's like, no, we don't have to be part of all the discussions, but we could still hang out with everybody. It's I don't know if that's related, but to the it's it yeah. But I think at this particular moment, I mean, this country has never been it's always been a very divided place in so many different ways, uncountable ways. But here we are in October 2020, and I don't need to lay the scene for you or anybody who's watching. But I just wonder if after just being a New Yorker living in Tennessee for decades, that alone, I just, you know, it, let alone every other kinds of experience you've had living in an intentional community, being gay, anything else that informs your perspective traveling all over the world. I'm just looking for thoughts on how people can get along in this country right now.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure that I really have suggestions to offer. I mean, you know, one thing is I think that this whole, you know, this whole idea that we're constantly seeing painted, that there are, like, you know, red states and blue states, you know, I think is pretty much absurd, because, you know, I mean, every place is a mix of people. And actually, you know, a month and a half ago, I took a road trip up to the Hudson Valley of New York to visit my elderly father. And, you know, I saw rebel flags up there, and I saw Trump signs up there, and you know, and then that's New York. And then, you know, where I live in Tennessee, you know, I mean, arguably, you know, I live in something of a bubble, but, you know, most of the people that I find myself interacting with, you know, are definitely not, you know, Republican identified, conservative, evangelical. Although, you know, I mean, I know lots of, you know, local people who I don't talk about, you know, politics with. I don't necessarily know, you know, sort of how everybody's voting. I mean, I've mostly had a very positive experience down here and met you know, all kinds of wonderful people, and you know, like being you know, let's say, like a bridge person, you know, between some of the people who are only comfortable staying more in a bubble and the community at large. How people can get along better? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm mystified about, you know, sort of how so many people come to hold the views that they have. I mean, honestly, I think that Fox News has a tremendous amount to do with it. You know, a few years ago, I was visiting my father and this sort of old family friend who's died since then. But, you know, she was like, you know, on oxygen, you know, in a hospital bed, you know, just like watching TV, probably 16 hours a day. And, you know, once I was visiting her, and she was like, okay, you follow politics and think a lot about politics. Help me understand, like, you know, like, why Barack Obama hates white people so much. And I just was like, how did you ever get that idea? You know, he just seems like he tries so hard to get along with everybody and be accommodating and whatever. So, but anyway, you know, she was just watching people who were telling her that, you know, he was, you know, sort of leading this big racial confrontation and that he hated white people. And she just believed that. I don't know how people come to believe some of the things that they believe. You know, I mean, my approach is mostly not to, you know, just, you know, not to go there with a lot of people, and to just, you know, sort of, you know, talk about fermentation or talk about something where we can possibly find some common ground, rather than like fighting about the things that we're, you know, sort of seeing completely differently.
And in daily life in rural Tennessee, I mean, I know this is true of myself from my own experience, but I think it's just worth just talking about for some of the people who are watching out there, who are, I mean, increasingly scared to leave their cities because they're afraid what they're going to run into in the countryside. I mean, it's becoming, you know, for some people, it's becoming that kind of a situation. But you talk to people.
Oh, I mean, I definitely go into town. I've never felt any concern about going into town. I went into town last week to go do early voting, and there was a long line, and, you know, no issues at all. But also, I mean, I want to acknowledge, you know, white privilege. I mean, really, as long as I've been living in Tennessee, you know, I have observed that when, you know, when Black people are visiting our community, or, you know, we've had, you know, lots of different Black people living in the communities, like they don't necessarily feel as casually about like taking a walk down the dirt road or, you know, or going alone into town because, you know, Black people who are sort of presenting in gender non-conforming ways feel much more vulnerable. And I have to acknowledge that. And that's not a brand new thing. I mean, that might be intensifying at the present time. But, you know, I think that that's been part of the that's just been part of the perception down here is that, you know, it's not, you know, it's potentially unsafe for you. You know, if you're someone who's feeling sort of more vulnerable.
And in terms of the history of the community there, has there been a lot, any particular conflict? I mean, like, I know on the farm, when people moved to the farm in the early 70s, eventually they had to put up a fence because there were folks coming in with pickup trucks and doing donuts around in the dirt lots and stuff like that, just to sort of be intimidating or be drunk or whatever. And I don't know. It's your experience has been.
I mean, my personal experience has been fine, but I mean, I have known people who have, you know, felt intimidated or scared in interactions that they've had with random people on the road. We definitely have had people, you know, we've had windshields smashed, we've had, you know, tires slashed, we've had, you know, people make a bonfire at the top of our driveway and burn things. So, I mean, through the years, we've had some, you know, occasional incidents, but, you know, they've really been the exception more than the rule. It's never been like persistent and, you know, for the most part, I would say that, you know, certainly at the level of like the, you know, the shopkeepers in town, you know, like, you know, they're happy to have our patronage and have always been very friendly. So, you know, I mean, not without incident, but I would say not with, you know, major incidents.
Are you getting the impression that there are a lot of people leaving the cities and moving into the countryside, or temporarily or permanently, since last March? Is that a phenomenon?
Well,
that's,
I mean, honestly, that's a phenomenon that's less noticeable to me here than, you know, talking to people who I know in places like the Hudson Valley or rural parts of Massachusetts. Sure. I mean, I think that's definitely a phenomenon. I mean, I'm not sure that I have, like, you know, witnessed it personally, right here.
That's interesting, because I would think that would be one of the prime places, but then again, you're not like going around on the dirt roads looking to see who's moved into this house. I mean, it's obviously, yeah, it's, but how I know you have to go in a few minutes, Sandra, but how have you adapted to the online reality of trying to do fermentation presentations online? I mean, the Cooking Channel has existed for a long time, so I guess we've got some precedent here on how this can be done. But
yeah, I mean, it's a mixed bag. I mean, for me personally, it's been such a gift, like, that all my travels were canceled, and it's been, you know, just really lovely to, you know, have a year at home without coming and going a lot. I mean, I had a lot of travels planned that got canceled. I had workshops that I was hosting here that I had to cancel. I mean, online teaching is great in a certain way. You know, especially, you know, if I compare it to like things where I was like standing in front of an auditorium. I mean, I don't think the experience is that different, you know, if you're a large number of people listening to someone speak, and then there's some time for questions at the end. And in a situation like that, I'm like, wow, okay, if I had actually gone there, it would have been like 2 days of travel, you know, plus just being at the event all day. On the other hand, obviously, especially for sort of smaller, more intimate kind of teaching, you know, you it's lacking the, you know, the hands-on component, you know, the very important component of being able to smell things. I feel like it's never as good being, sort of online trying to teach people how to do something than, you know, being in the same room with them. I'm glad I'm just doing it an hour or two at a time. I mean, you know, I was talking to my nephew who's like, you know, doing this for, you know, 6 or 8 hours a day, in his senior year of high school. And, you know, and a friend who's a teacher who's on it all day. I mean, it just seems, it seems like it could be really, awful to be tethered to the computer and staring at the screen, for many hours every day. I've also been writing another book. I should tell you and your listeners that I just released a book, and because I'm on this thing, I can't come here. I'm going to go grab it. I'll be 10 Good. Seconds.
Excellent. You are watching Fifth Estate Live. We're talking to Sander Katz, Tennessee.
Under here you're running the title of one of my books that was published in 2006, The Revolution Will Not Be Microwaved, Inside America's Underground Food Movements. Before that, I published Wild Fermentation, which came out in 2003 and was revised in 2016. My biggest book is The Art of Fermentation, and that was released in 2012. But just like last month, my latest book, which is not really a how-to book at all. I mean, it's really a reflection on how we use the word fermentation as a metaphor. So, you know, people talk about a time of great political fermentation, or alternatively musical fermentation or artistic fermentation. So it's just sort of it's a meditation on this along with all this incredible microscopy imagery. So this is hot off the presses, fermentation as metaphor. But I've been using the lockdown time to write really like a fermentation travelogue book. I mean, I've taught in about 25 countries and visited a handful more. And everywhere I go, I get to sort of taste what the local indigenous ferments are and learn things. And so I'm working on a travelogue book that'll be out next year.
Oh, fantastic! It's like basically a memoir of.
A travel-based memoir. Let's call it a geographically organized memoir.
So you're putting things into a lot of context then, when you're like, rather than just traveling, talking about your travels, you're writing a lot about where you are and what people eat there and that sort of thing.
It has recipes and photos and stories and. But ground mostly focusing on the food. I mean, not 100%. I mean, I'm also talking about people I meet and impressions of places, but it's really focusing on fermentation.
Excellent. And when it says at Sander Kraut, is that on Twitter? Are you on Twitter?
I'm technically on Twitter as Sander Kraut, but I rarely use it. I use Instagram as Sander Kraut.
Very good.
So Instagram is the place where I post the most. I also have a website, which is wildfermentation.com. And somewhere in the archives of the Fifth Estate, I have written about fermentation for the Fifth Estate.
Indeed, you have. And before you run, do you have any particular predictions for the future, whether that's the next few weeks or the next few months?
Well, I mean, I just think that... we need more social and political ferment. I mean, it just seems like things are changing. Things need to change, and people and grassroots movements really have to be what sort of drives the change. Otherwise, the changes can be terrible. So I just want to encourage people to, certainly want to encourage people in the U.S. to vote, but also, voting is the beginning, not the end. And, we need to be, in the streets and making our voices heard.
Fantastic advice. Completely concur. Thanks so much, Sander. And next time we'll try not to mess up the scheduling.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
No worries. Great to talk to you, David. Take care. Have a good day.
You too. And that was a half-hour discussion with Sander Katz there in Tennessee. And the show is continuing now without any guests other than the host, who is now the guest. And this is this is Fifth Estate Live. It actually is produced by Peter Werby, who is on the editorial collective of Fifth Estate Magazine, which comes to you four times a year in print form. And as it says on the bottom of the screen, if you go to fifthestate.org, you can read about that and subscribe to the magazine, or just get one copy in the mail. However, the producer, we got unplugged there for a minute, sorry. The producer, Peter Werby, has instructed me to sing some songs for you for the last half of this show. And I've never done that with my own shows before, but it's a fine idea. So I'm going to do it. Did I mention it was it was a scheduling thing. We were going to have him on for the hour, and then we got time zones confused, and then as it turned out, that didn't work. And so rather than rescheduling or whatever, we just went ahead with doing the show during the normal time. I think I've already messed up my introduction, because one of the things Peter always told me as a host is never apologize. I think that might have been an apology, but you don't know. It wasn't. I'm not apologizing. I'm going to sing songs for you. No apology necessary. I've got a new album out called Say Their Names. It's going to be on all the various streaming platforms sometime next month. And it's more or less a history of what's been going on in Portland for the past few months. But I am going to start out with a song from the album, and then I even came up with a set list for what to do here. We'll see what we get through. If this were an anarchist jurisdiction, as the president likes to say, then Kendra James and Quanis Hayes would be alive today. They would not have been gunned down by a racist police force, because we would have defunded it long ago, of course. Taking all that money to spend on things that people need, not violent gangs of thugs in blue making people bleed. If this were an anarchist jurisdiction, as the Attorney General tells, then we would have already emptied all those prison cells, housing the mentally ill and so many, many more who are only locked up for being sick or being poor or for having been set up or for crimes of poverty. There'd be none of that nonsense under our authority. If this were an anarchist jurisdiction, it'd be a beautiful scene with so much less asphalt, so much more green. And there would be no tear gas, no eviction raids. You'd see what solutions look like when they're not just band-aids. If the people ran this city, not just millionaires, we'd take the stolen profits, that which they call theirs. If this were an anarchist jurisdiction, as the brown shirts oft repeat, you would not see these tents and couches lining every street. Without control by corporate interests that dominate our lives, making sure that they have everything while we're lucky to survive. It's profit over people, no matter how much blood they shed. If we were calling the shots, then you could turn that on its head. If this were an anarchist jurisdiction, and as we are in this situation where so many names are being said of so many people who have been killed by the police, and others who have been mortally wounded or maimed or otherwise, there's for all the names that are being said, there's so many names that aren't being said. And this is a song about one of those people who you don't hear being talked about, and I think one of the many people who should be getting talked about. And his name is Alvaro Luna Hernandez, and he's been in prison since 1996, and he's coming up for parole next year. Alvaro Luna Hernandez started life with a sword in hand, growing up in Texas on occupied land. His troubles with the law and with the sheriff of Alpine resulted from a racist gang crossing every line of respect for human decency. Vicious thugs in blue who have ruled the hills of Texas since long before 52. In the middle of the 20th, when Alvaro was born, it wasn't long before the first time he was torn from the streets of Alpine to a windowless cell. When the cops kicked in his head, till no one could tell if he'd live or die, and somehow he was breathing still when the morning sun was shining in the Texas hills. Alvaro Luna Hernandez grew up to lead the fight against police corruption and for human rights. Falsely accused of murder, incessantly harassed, a young life in constant danger, quickly flying past. So on the day a cop came to his house, pointed his gun, Alvaro knocked it out of the officer's hands, and he did run. Alvaro Luna Hernandez hid out underground after the biggest manhunt in West Texas. They fired many rounds. He managed to surrender without being shot, and that was the last breath out of prison that he ever got. The trial was a sham, and he was given 50 years. Sentenced by the machine to be ground up in the gears. Since 1996, a quarter century ago, in solitary confinement, they've kept Alvaro. He's now lived to be an old man, and whether he ever leaves, justice in the USA exists only for the thieves who came and stole this country, declared it to be theirs. Slave masters in power, Chicanos in the crosshairs. Alvaro Luna Hernandez started life with a shorted hand, growing up in Texas on occupied land. Now, if I could have, I'm having trouble seeing comments these days, and I've noticed that most of them tend to be kind of inane and unrelated to anything that's going on the screen anyway. So I tended to not be paying as much attention to them as I did when I first started doing these broadcasts, and then realized that it's not probably a good idea to spend too much time reading comments that aren't related, because then you just go and ah half the time while you're supposed to be, you know, making a little bit more sense than that. So comments in advance are good. And speaking of comments in advance, I do a solo concert from my living room here on the last Saturday of every month at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. And this month, on October 31st, I'll be doing songs that people might want to actually learn how to play, because people ask me about that. And so I'm going to do a visual illustration of how to play different songs that people want to know how to play. So you can write me if you got one in mind. But I'll just continue with this set list that I decided on doing after Peter said I should play songs for Fifth Estate Live. This is another title track of my new album. Jacob Blake is walking to his SUV. Alton Sterling was selling DVDs. Eric Garner had just broken up a fight. Breonna Taylor was asleep in the middle of the night. Tanya Rice was playing in the park. Eliza McLean was out walking after dark. Dominique Clayton was sleeping in her bed, where she was shot by a cop in the back of her head. Say their names. Say their names. Say their names. Say their names. Walter Scott was driving to a store. Betty Jones was answering her door. Philando Castile was driving home with his girlfriend. Anthony Hill was naked on the grass when he met his end. Edsel Ford was walking in his neighborhood. Michael Brown was blown away just standing where he stood. Kendra James was shot to death at a traffic stop by yet another unaccountable killer cop. Say their names. Say their names. Say their names. Say their names. Atiana Jefferson was playing a video game with her little nephew, gunned down just the same. Oscar Grant was celebrating the new year, handcuffed when the shots rang out that everyone could hear. Eric Reason pulled into a parking spot. Not long after that was when he was shot. George Floyd was just shopping in a store. Micah Xavier Johnson thought he was still at war. Say their names. Say their names. Say their names. Say their names. People paying much attention to the news, which is quite a lot of the people watching this broadcast, I suspect, are well aware that there's a trial going on right now in London that is going to have all sorts of implications for a lot of people in the world. There's a good video of this song, me singing this song in front of Belmarsh Prison. Behind these prison walls, there's a man who's won awards for the work that he has done and all that it affords, such as the knowledge of the horrors
committed in our name. They can't stop the message, so the messenger gets blamed. Behind these prison walls, in solitary confinement, in a land of rolling hills and royalty and other such refinement, is someone who is a hero to whistleblowers everywhere, who helped them tell the world of the crimes of Tony Blair. Behind these prison walls, you will find a mortal man. The reason why we know what happened in Afghanistan, when the soldiers of the empire, whose sunset long before, were torturing civilians in their terror war. Behind these prison walls is a part of WikiLeaks, an eloquent orator, but you won't hear him speak. Locked away in silence, one who knows too well how those in power act when there's another war to sell. Behind these prison walls is one who stands accused of exactly what offenses the U.S. has refused to say precisely which, or to try to clear the mist, or to explain how he's not the same as other journalists. Behind these prison walls is a person they deprive of most of the things in life that keep us all alive. A person being tortured as we stand here now for revealing the war crimes. Why, when, where, how? Behind these prison walls, our very right to be informed of what the hell is going on is a teacup in this storm. With knowledge there is power, so the solution by the crown, a 24-hour-a-day indefinite lockdown. Behind these prison walls.
I have one more song in the little set list that I'll do for you guys watching Fifth Estate Live, which comes to you every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, noon Central Time. And it comes to you on various platforms, including the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and KABU Community Radio, as well as my own Facebook pages and Periscope and Twitter and YouTube and VK, LinkedIn, all sorts of places that nobody watches on, but people watch on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Twitch. It's on Twitch. And as Glenn Ford said, the capitalists really do control our means of communication. Paraphrasing. He used the word hegemonic. As he will. It's a good word. I'm going to be back tomorrow with my Discussions with David show, which is most Wednesdays and Fridays at the same time as Fifth Estate Live on all of the same platforms at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Although, unlike Fifth Estate Live, it does not appear on the fifthestate.org website where you can find all of these Fifth Estate Live broadcasts archived. You can also find all of these broadcasts by looking for the podcast This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform. And I'll just do one more song, which is another I wrote during the pandemic, prior to the latest CD. I found as a person who has also, like our previous wonderful guest from the first half hour of this show, traveled a lot in a lot of different countries, I have found that if we want to try to imagine how life could be different here in the U.S., it's pretty essential to look outside of the U.S. for some good examples. It's also very helpful to look at history. It's at moments like these, everything is in the air. The possibilities are nowhere and everywhere. You gotta break a bone to set it. Now all we are is broke. A lot of folks saying it's time to be woke. But they're not talking about microaggressions, but the really big ones. The basic assumptions, like planets circling suns. But there are no natural laws that built your mansions or your tents. These are creations of society, like mortgages and rent. It's a future of uncertainty. But our liberation can only be as free as our imagination. If you were born and raised to believe it's sacrosanct that whoever has a whole lot of money in the bank deserves to then live off of the wealth from the houses that they own, and if they raise your rent, you can move or take out a loan, then how can you demand your human rights? If you don't believe you have any, as if you deserve your plight. But if things were hard before, now the system has flatlined. Time for those basic rights to be redefined. It's a future of uncertainty. But our liberation can only be as free as our imagination. These vaunted freedoms added to the Constitution as an afterthought after Shays' Rebellion did not include the right to land, or the right to eat, or the right for human beings not to be dying on the street. It's moments like these, standing on the edge, that we might catch the strongest breeze to land furthest from the ledge. We can fly, you know. All you need is wings. We can house and feed each other together. We can do anything. It's a future of uncertainty. But our liberation can only be as free as our imagination. It's at moments like these, everything is in the air. The possibilities are nowhere and everywhere. And this has been another episode of Fifth Estate Live, which comes to you every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, right here on whatever platform you're watching on, archived afterwards as a podcast if you look for This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform. And I hope to see some of you tomorrow for my broadcast Discussions with David at the same time, same place, with someone who has been to a whole lot of protests. And then I'll be back on Friday with more conversations with interesting people. And at the end of the month, October 31st, I'll be doing a concert here on the internet as well. And if anybody wants to learn how to play a song that I wrote or that I know, then drop me a line, drovix@gmail.com or david@davidrovix.com, and I will respond to your message, unless it goes into the NSA's don't read this message folder because the NSA has stolen it, and then I won't read it because the NSA has stolen it, but then hopefully you can keep trying. I'm on Signal. All right. Take care, everybody. Mutual aid will get us through. Remember, trust your neighbors. Don't trust the cops. Don't pay the rent. And see you soon. And take care till then. And after then, too. Bye for now.